BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the illusionist and mentalist Derren Brown. He started out doing table magic in Bristol restaurants, but over the course of his 20-year career, sleight of hand has become sleight of mind. His award-winning shows have evolved to encompass an ever more daring blend of psychology, illusion, hypnosis, suggestion, memory, and perception. He's played Russian roulette on live TV, predicted winning lottery numbers, convinced a bunch of middle managers to commit armed robbery, and hoodwinked one man into believing that the apocalypse has taken place, leaving only him and a few zombies behind. If there is a common thread in this varied portfolio, it might be an enduring fascination with the nature of belief, the stories we tell ourselves about what is true. Once an evangelical Christian, he is now a committed atheist. He's written a book about philosophy and happiness and has a sideline in uncovering tricksters who manipulate other people's credulity for their own ends, debunking the methods of psychics, mediums, faith healers, New Age gurus and ghost hunters. He says, "I think as you grow up, you realise that being impressive is actually not an important thing. Being nice, open and kind, they're the things I warm to in people. So the TV shows have become less about, hey, look at me, I can do this, and more about me facilitating things for others." Derren Brown, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Hello, that was a lovely introduction, thank you.
Not many people can call themselves a mentalist. For those who might not be familiar with the term, how do you describe that art form?
Mentalist is the technical term for what I do, and it really, I suppose it probably covers everything from, I don't know, from psychic mediums through Uri Geller through to magicians doing tricks with a sort of mental theme. But my interest was definitely in the psychological aspects of it, sometimes in psychological methods, sometimes a psychological effect, even if you're using conjuring techniques to get there.
Can magic be meaningful, I wonder?
Absolutely, yeah. It's taken me 15 years of doing stage shows to kind of realise it, because it's so caught up in vaudeville silliness in a way and the childish urge to impress. But what I think it does have going on, which is interesting, is that magic's a very good analogy for how we generally face the world. We have this infinite data source coming at us. There's an infinite number of things that we could think about or pay attention to, but we choose what to pay attention to, and we edit and delete and so on. And this, we start to make up a story of what's going on, and then we mistake that story for the truth. And that's exactly what a magician's doing. You know, you see a card trick and then you say, well, I just thought of a card, and then it disappeared, and then it was in my pocket. And you miss out from that story all the other little bits that are actually very important, but they didn't seem important at the time, which is normally how magic works. It's not that you know, hand is quicker than the eye. It's just you only paid attention to certain things because you only thought certain things were important. But that is what we do every day in life. There's always other stuff going on that we don't see and don't know about. That's a really, I think, a big lesson.
We're going to hear your first piece of music now. Tell us about it. Why have you chosen this one?
I realised, putting this list together, this is the only happy piece. They're all, I really apologise if
make the most of this
show
everyone
depresses anybody. Yeah, this is a Gloria by Vivaldi. And this became, particularly when I was on tour, and still do tour, I would put this on and step out. And even if you were in an unlovely part of the country on a rainy day, this would really brighten things up. It's a real beautiful start to the day. It's just, well, it's glorious. You see what I did? I used the word Gloria and changed it.
Thank you.
Vivaldi's Gloria, sung by the choir of St John's College, Cambridge, with the Wren Orchestra, conducted by George Guest. Darren Brown, some of your allusions have been extremely controversial, particularly when you played Russian Roulette live on television, which was in October 2003. Do you get a kick out of pushing the envelope and seeing how far you can go?
It's never been about that. I mean, I have done shows that have created some controversy, but I've done plenty of others that haven't and have been quite sort of, you know, quiet and understated. The key for me has only been finding a strong idea, like a clear dramatic hook, like we're going to end the world for somebody and then they wake up and it's full of zombies, or could you get someone to murder somebody using nothing but social compliance at a, you know, big party, everyone's an actor apart from one person that doesn't know they're being filmed and so on. So kind of ideas that feel to me like, oh, I'd watch that because that sounds interesting, and then having a subtext that makes it worth doing and feel intelligent and not just about the shock value. And that's really all I think about. If you aim to be controversial for the sake of it, you'd end up with a very thin and sort of meaningless show.
And what about danger? I mean, have you or anybody who's taken part in one of your tricks ever been in danger? I know your mum was a bit upset about the Russian roulette at the time.
Well, she was, as we would expect, nervous for me, but also, I guess, trusted that I knew what I was doing. I did smash a screw through my hand recently whilst practising a magic trick where you put a nail or a screw under paper cups or paper bags or something. I was going to go on the James Corden show in America. Because this was only for me to just run the words, no one needed to put the screw. This is a 6-inch screw, like on a little base, pointing upwards under one of 3 cups. No one needed to put the screw under the cup, and I certainly didn't need to smash my hand down on it. And also because we were just running it for the words, I didn't do the thing that allows me to be confident where it is. So otherwise, if I smashed my hand down and had this 5-inch screw. Hilariously, I've seen so much footage of other people doing this, which I can no longer watch. And when I did this, my first thought was, oh, I'm now one of those people. I've now done it. I had this screw, and it was a screw. Normally it's done with a nail. A screw's a different animal. I tried unscrewing it as well, which really hurt. Never do that. And I had to go to the hospital and have this thing removed.
It's time to go to the music. We're going to hear your second disc today, Darren Brown. What's it going to be?
This is the Goldberg Variations by Bach. This has followed me around for a long time, this bit of music. I think I first heard it in the film Silence of the Lambs, and it becomes a bit of a motif of Hannibal Lecter's. I love that film. I watched it as a student.
Is it true that he's part of your stage persona, or he was an influence?
Yeah, there are a few little sort of touch points for the sort of character, for want of a better word, I guess. Character in the sense that often as I'm forming the sort of plots for Illusions, Sherlock Holmes is one that's been, Willy Wonka's another one, and Hannibal Lecter, which is unpleasant because obviously he's a serial killer. So that's where I discovered this bit of music.
Bach's Goldberg Variations, performed by Murray Pariah. So, Darren Brown, you were born in 1971 in Croydon and describe yourself as a precocious and revoltingly charming child. Tell me more.
Yes, I was, and probably still am. I had long platinum locks, by which I mean my hair. I was an only child till I was 9, which means I would obviously play on my own, and I think that is something you take with you into later life if you've grown up playing on your own. Most of my interests now are quite sort of solitary. Apparently when I was could barely speak, I was taken to my great aunt's house and came in through the front garden, and then when I said hello to her, my opening words were, "Oh, great aunt, I think your garden is simply marvellous." This is like at the age of, you know, 2 or something. I found out an anagram of Darren Victor Brown. I worked out his born crowd inverter. Victor being my middle name. So there's probably a little bit of me, even at an early age, that enjoyed sort of charming and manipulating.
How did that go down at school?
I think I was the classic, not sporty, quite good at English and art. I was very good at drawing witches when I was five, I remember, and I started at kindergarten. A lot of witches. I went to kind of a sporty school, and my dad was a swimming teacher, was the swimming teacher, the swimming coach at school, which made it very difficult to get out of games, which was mainly what I was trying to do, was get away from sports. I was not bullied, but I was certainly kind of intimidated by the sporty kids, particularly as a sort of, you know, was going to be a closeted gay kid for quite a long time as well. So I don't look back fondly on any of that.
We're going to hear your third disc now. What have you chosen?
This is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 9. But I've chosen this one because it's the first CD I ever bought. And this was around the time that CDs were quite rare and new. And I had been to this concert at the Berlin Philharmonic in Berlin. I was on a sort of a school exchange. I have so many memories tied in with this. I had bought the CD at the end of the concert, but I had cleared out two rows of the concert, cleared out two rows with my weird sniffing. If you can imagine the loudest snort that you, if you really, really pushed it and tried for the loudest sniff you could do. I had to do this like a lot all the time, particularly once I was thinking about it. It's just excruciating thinking back to it. And I remember people around me offering me a tissue and me saying, no, thank you, I'm fine. And then the interval happened and came back after the interval and there was just no one around us. I'd completely cleared it. And then on the way out, I bought this CD because I wanted to have a CD. And it's become part of my kind of DNA now. I listen to it every day. And I when I'm thinking about the desert island, I think all these things would remind me so much of home and would have such a lovely, comfortable nostalgia to them. So I couldn't not include it. This is the opening.
The first movement from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 9 in E-flat major, performed by Maria João Piros with the Gulbenkian Orchestra, conducted by Theodor Guschelbauer. Darren Brown, we've heard a little bit about your dad, who coached swimming at the school that you went to. Tell me about your mum.
She's quite glamorous. She's a former model. Then she had a number of different jobs after that. Her last sort of long-term job was running a doctor's surgery, the sort of admin side of that, which she did for a long time and loved. They're lovely. And they've always had this very relaxed approach to me sort of, well, it always felt very relaxed from my end, of me just doing what I enjoyed. And I never felt any, the only thing I ever felt any pressure to do was to learn how to drive. And I don't drive. And I was, I did the lessons and failed. And then I said, well, that's it. I had a go and I failed. So that's it. I never went back. But that felt outrageous that they'd even try and persuade me to do that. And I wrote them a letter at my end of my first year at university, thanking them, because I realised I was amongst all these other law students that were really nervous and felt all this pressure to do well in their exams, not for themselves, but for what their parents would think. And I'd never come across that. I didn't know that was a thing. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for that.
During your teenage years, it sounds like your early attempts at sleight of hand weren't of the legal variety. As a teenager, you acquired quite the shoplifting habit.
It's so awful. I'm laughing about it, but only out of embarrassment, because it's so shameful. But yeah, I did. And I stopped. It was never anything, you know, expensive. But I remember looking around my bedroom once as a teenager and realising now that my parents are probably listening to this, but I looked around and every single thing in my room I'd stolen.
Your jumpers must have been massive.
Yeah, big bulky jumpers, lots of inside pockets. I've stopped now, and I stopped because, bet, I set off the alarms sneaking out of the music department of Harrods with a Luther Vandross cassette tape in my pocket. And I was so embarrassed, so I could see two store detectives walking towards me. So I did this whole display of, oh, how did that get there? Oh, how embarrassing. And put it back, and that was it. I thought, right, that's it, no more. So I have not stolen since.
Not since Luther. Did your parents know about that?
They do now. I think I probably, yeah, I probably mentioned it.
What was it about, do you think, though?
Just an absolute sort of pragmatic thing of, I loved the gadgets, they were too expensive to buy, so I'd steal them. And I think the sneaky, the challenge of... this is before, the magic thing took off, but it was the joy of the misdirection and the fun of pilfering and not being seen. And I mean, it was just joyful, but terrible. I'm not remotely condoning it.
What's your next piece and why have you chosen it?
This is the Erbarmerdich from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. And it's one of the most beautiful pieces of music I think ever written. What I love about this, it's a yearning for mercy from God, from Peter, who's just denied Jesus three times. So as an atheist now, I still feel the experience of transcendence is something that's hugely important, and we need to find it somewhere in life, not necessarily in a spiritual way. And what's always touched me about a lot of religious music, and you see the same thing architecturally with cathedrals, the same thing of reaching out. There's a sort of a yearning and a reaching that you can hear or see and stand and walk around in, which is a very human thing. It doesn't really matter what you're reaching for, whether there's anything there or not, but the act of reaching and yearning is, I think, a very touching and fundamental part of the human experience, which I think a lot of atheists miss when they have pops at religion nowadays. And for me, this is just a lovely articulation of that. It's a beautiful piece.
Erbarmerdich from Bach's St. Matthew Passion, sung by Michael Chance, accompanied by the Brandenburg Consort, conducted by Stephen Cleobury. Derren Brown, after a gap year learning to ballroom dance in Nuremberg, which honestly I feel warrants a whole programme of its own, you applied to Bristol University to study law and German. What plan did you have for yourself at that time?
Well, I thought I was going to be an international lawyer. I realised soon I didn't want to become a lawyer or a German. And then from then on, it all just became about what was fun in the moment. And I just remember thinking, if I take a cross-section of my life, does it feel like it's in the right place? And it did. And then that was all I ever wanted, and I never moved beyond that.
So a lot of people who didn't have very happy experiences at school, they quite often reinvent themselves at university. And it sounds like that was the case for you. During this period, you've said your look was Bad Spandau Ballet, Gay Leisure Pirate, which I think sounds amazing.
Yes.
Talk me through that.
I wore a cloak for many years. I had long hair. A, I had hair. B, I had long hair. I may have had a drop earring for about a week. Yeah, I sort of fancied myself as a sort of philosopher poet, but was, yeah, somewhere more in the gay female leisure pirate. And I used to go to a cave that was hidden on one side of the Avon Gorge. It's sort of under the suspension bridge, if anyone knows Clifton. I'm sure it's still there. And I would sit, light a bonfire, and read Nietzsche. Because that's what I was like.
And the fake eye?
I had this liquid latex, which I would use sometimes with painting as a way of masking areas of the paper. I put some of this latex on my eye, just a little bit, one morning, because it looked like, you know, like special effects makeup. It looked like, you know, I'd hurt my eye.
Curiosity got the better of you. We've all been there.
Exactly. I went down to breakfast and I loved the attention. When friends asked, so what did you do to your eye? I made something up. I just, rather than saying, oh, it's just latex, I made something up. And then I felt obliged to put a bit more on and continue this story, which then I couldn't back out of, because day by day, and I'm adding more and more until in the end I'm disfigured on one side of my face. But I couldn't back out of it because I was telling people that cared that this was a real thing. I mean, so odd when I think back. I remember the guy upstairs, because we had like communal baths and things, he thought it was his fault because he'd been making beer in the bath and he thought the fumes had made this happen. And oh, it's just terrible. This is all really weird, twisted bids for attention. I think once I started performing, it felt like it took care of all that. I could take all that pathetic, insecure mess and just funnel it into, you know, a kind of valid arena of, you know, of performing. It helped a lot.
Time for some more music. This is your fifth disc. Why have you chosen this one?
Yes, this is the Cello Suites. Again, Bach. I've always loved music that needs unlocking. And music that is sort of private. Most of the music here has a sort of private feel and a solitary feel. I first heard this played to me by the friend I used to go to the cave with and read Nietzsche. What I loved about it was it felt just like an outpouring. It didn't feel like anybody could have sat down and composed it. I'm choosing the version by Stephen Isserlis, and it's a beautiful, woody recording. The main reason why I've chosen this version, though, is that I know Stephen, and he will not let me live it down if I didn't choose his version. So this is the finest version in the world, Stephen Isserlis.
The Prelude from Bach's Cello Suite No. 1, performed by Stephen Isserlis. So, Derren Brown, you were trying your hand as a magician in Bristol. What was a typical week like for you? What kind of gigs were you getting?
There were a couple of restaurants I would work at, and from that I would get the occasional private booking, you know, for someone's wedding or perhaps a corporate event. It was just enough to tick by.
Was it easy to be with people and not be kind of on?
No, I think it just goes back to the whole closety gay thing. I think it's you just develop a sort of way of being that's constantly deflecting. I kind of had to, I think, learn how to just be normally with people, because what wasn't helping was the magic as well, because I'd always have tricks and things in my pocket, and then I was just always waiting to impress, which is such a red herring in life, isn't it? The desire to sort of impress. It feels like that's what you should be doing. It's the one thing you shouldn't be doing is trying to impress, because it's the one thing people aren't impressed by. I mean, it's such a, you know, it just shoots itself in the foot as soon as you start. But that's really, for years, that was my thing. I was always having to do a trick and actually just having a normal conversation, developing normal social skills, which is why, you know, a lot of magicians, you look at them and you can see the lonely child somewhere in the background. It took me a long time. And actually, I think getting well known helped, because you become suddenly much more aware of making a good impression, and what people actually sort of think of you becomes more of a thing. And again, now I'm the opposite. I never do tricks for people in real life. I find it really childish and silly and dishonest and all sorts of reasons why I don't like doing it.
It's time for some more music. This is your sixth disc. Why have you chosen it?
I love Richard Strauss. I love the four last songs, but I didn't know which one to pick, so I went for Morgan instead, which is a separate beautiful song. It has a lovely blend of beauty. It's a song about two lovers walking down onto a beach, looking forward to going down the beach and kissing, and it's a sort of lovely thing, but it's achingly sad. And I think that is, for me, a very powerful thing. I think life is centripetal in that it pulls us towards the centre, not to the outside. And we have a million distractions and things that keep us busy, but ultimately we're pulled back to the middle, which is why I'm not a big believer in optimism and believing in yourself and so on, because when those things let you down on a bad day, you've got nowhere to go other than, oh, I must have just failed. I much prefer the Stoic approach of making peace with failure and fortune and moving in easier accord with it rather than trying to fight against it, not trying to control the things that are out of your control. But what it means is that central point in life has to allow for melancholy and has to allow for a certain dose of sadness to have a sort of a sweetness to it. And it means that then those low points or those sad points actually can bind us together in a way that's beautiful and gives us room to love. And this piece of music, I think it really does that. It's sad and it's beautiful, and beautiful things pass, and that's why they're sad, and it's all of life for me.
Morgan by Richard Strauss, performed by Dame Felicity Lott and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Nima Yervi. Darren Brown, there is an interesting moral dimension to the art form that you practice. You've managed to get people to do some unbelievable things, to steal a painting, agree to hide what they think is a dead body. How conscious are you of the ethical complexities of what you're doing?
Hugely. One thing that really helps is the fact that I really only make one or two of these shows a year. So there's a lot of time, as opposed to those kind of makeover, life turnaround shows that, you know, maybe it's every week somebody's sort of, you know, churned out on this sort of conveyor belt when there's less time for attention. So it's hugely important to us. If you're putting somebody through a dark journey, A, there's got to be a good reason for doing it, so that their experience of it and their story of it to themselves is worth doing. First of all, they're vetted beforehand. That's a whole interesting thing in itself, as to how, without letting somebody know they're part of a show, that they do go through this vetting procedure, which has to be rigorous. The actual experience itself is carefully sort of curated and orchestrated so that they're always on the right side of feeling safe. The sort of immediate aftercare is hugely important. And this isn't just me doing it. We also have independent people that are there too.
It's time for your seventh disc today. Why have you chosen this one?
Number seven is Rufus Wainwright. I love Rufus Wainwright. And again, it's another sort of sad and beautiful thing. I paint a lot, and Rufus has become my go-to painting music. The story of the song, I understand, is that so Rufus' father is Loudon Wainwright III, a huge name in folk music, who had left the family when Rufus was younger. But they came together and Rufus had done an interview with Rolling Stone magazine and had mentioned his father and got these magazines out at dinner and made a joke about, oh, I've got you back into Rolling Stone magazine, Dad. And his father was furious, saying, you know, I don't need you to get me into Rolling Stone and so on. And it led to this huge argument that brought up all these issues. That's as I understand the story, and it's just a beautiful, gorgeous, sad song.
No matter how strong, I'm gonna take you down with one. I'm gonna break you down and see what you're worth, what you're really worth to me.
Dinner at eight. Rufus Wainwright and Dinner at Eight. Derren Brown, not all of the journeys are dark. In some of your more recent programmes, you've explored the positive changes that participants can make, overcoming their fears and anxieties, and even in some cases, physical ailments that they're suffering that have a kind of psychological element.
Yeah, the last stage show I did was based around faith healing. And it was, I think, of all the things that I've done, the most extraordinary experience to perform. I'd thought about doing it before, but it made no sense that it would work with my audience because there's no way we'd advertise it as a healing show. Didn't want people coming needing healing. That's a very different thing. People would be sceptical like me. And just all that kind of psychological priming that you have if you go and see one of these events for real just wouldn't be there. So I didn't know if it was going to work. And it really did. And I know that if you took an x-ray before and afterwards, nothing has changed. All I've done is I've created a bit of adrenaline, which is a painkiller. So that's one part of it. And the other part is interrupted the story that people might be living out about what their ailment is, that they just carry around with them every day. And for some people, that's enough.
And how do you explain that?
It's exactly that thing. I think it's the story that we tell ourselves, the stories. But again, it was a small percentage of the audience. And if you take 2,000 people, that 1% or whatever is always going to be extraordinary anyway. So that's your starting point. You can kind of, if you just grit your teeth on the first night and hope it's going to happen, you can kind of rely that something extraordinary will happen. And the oddest things that seemed so physical, I thought somebody might say, well, my back hurt and now it doesn't, but really physical things were just...
What, like
what? I remember a guy with trigger finger one night. I just remember this because I had a friend, it was a guy who was 70 who had trigger finger, and it was, you know, horrible, horrible thing. Just, you know, couldn't move his thumb and finger. And this guy just, he couldn't believe it. He was able to move. And most nights there'd be something that would really knock me back. Slip discs that seemingly had gone, movement that was people were able to do that they weren't able to do before. I mean, it was extraordinary.
It's time for your final disc today. Tell me about this one.
This is Ben Folds, The Luckiest, which was first played to me by my friend James Rhodes, who is a now well-established concert pianist. It's, again, beauty and sadness meeting at an achingly beautiful level. Whenever I hear this, I just am filled with a sappy love for my partner and immediately rush upstairs and get him to listen to it, which he's not interested in the song at all.
He's not his thing.
Not remotely interested in it. But I love it. And it's lyrics that are sad and, again, bring that sort of note of melancholy into beauty, which is so important, and so important not to try and shut that out, but to let it sit and be part of the whole experience.
I don't get many things right the first time. In fact, I am told that a lot. Now I know all the wrong turns and stumbles and falls brought me here.
Ben Folds and The Luckiest. So, Derren Brown, I'm sending you away to our island with three books, mm-hmm. the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and one of your choosing. What will it be?
I've always loved Boswell's London Journals, which I was going to choose, but right now I'm really in love with Jung, Carl Gustav Jung. So I would take... I've been reading around him for many years, but I've just started reading the original works. So I'm taking the collected works of C.G. Jung, and that will keep me going for a while. I just hope my interest is maintained in them. And I'll have plenty of time for sort of self-therapy on this island, so I think
exactly.
it'll be a good place to start.
Dig into your archetypes, enjoy.
Yes.
What about a luxury, something to make your time on the island more bearable?
I'm a lover of stupid gadgets. I had a hot towel dispenser, I remember, which I never used, and a bread maker, which I've never used, endless things. I'm taking my camera. I have a Leica camera, which is goes everywhere with me. And I'm sort of aware there won't be a huge amount of street photography to do on the island, which is sort of my main thing. But I think it'd be an interesting photography project, given the limitations of the one palm tree and any number of fish. And interesting light. I think the light would probably be interesting. So as long as I can take film and or charger and spare SD cards, then I'm taking my little camera.
And finally, which one of these discs would you save above the others if you had to?
I'll go for the Goldberg variations. They're the longest and they just keep on giving and they keep on unlocking more and more. It's hard to let go of the Strauss, hard to let go of Morgan, but yeah, I'll go Goldberg variations.
Derren Brown, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with
thank
us.
Thank you. It's been such a joy. Thank you so much.
As we leave Derren on his desert island getting stuck into his collection of Jung, there's just time for me to remind you that there's a whole range of fascinating castaways in our back catalogue. Among them are Victoria Wood, the Doctor, David Knott, rugby referee Nigel Evans and Yoko Ono. And you can hear all those and many more programmes on BBC Sounds. Derren chose the cellist Stephen Isserlis's recording of the Bach Cello Suites. Back in 2007, Stephen was also cast away on our desert island by Kirsty Young.
I certainly don't remember any sort of life without music, because my father played the violin and my mother was a piano teacher, so I think I would go to sleep as a baby or certainly as a little child to the sound of them practicing. You know, we were surrounded by music.
I mean, in the introduction there, I said that the cello was chosen for you so as you could complete the family sound, but given that it was almost foist upon you. You were happy, once you had time to think about it, that this was the instrument that had been chosen for you.
Well, actually, I think when I first started, I must have been four or five, and I used to think it was terribly funny to play on the wrong side of the bridge, which makes this horrible squeaky sound, and I wouldn't stop doing that. So they made me stop lessons. And I still remember lying on the floor and crying my eyes out, feeling so humiliated. It must have been quite a moment for me still to remember it. And then, so they sent me back when I was six and grown up. And, of course, by then I was dying to play the cello, to redeem myself.
You own more than one cello, and is it three?
Well, no, I have access to three or four, yes.
And they all have different characters?
Very different characters. It's my old Guadagnini cello from 1745, which I played for a long time, and I now share with one of my best friends, who's called David Waterman. And then I'm trying to buy a Montignana cello from 1740. Is much tougher than the old... I mean, they really do have these incredibly different characters. And then the Nippon Music Foundation of Japan have, for the past 8 years, loaned me a Stradivarius from 1730, which is a beautiful instrument, a sort of dreamy, delicate, poetic instrument. I love it. So, yes, I got a complicated love life when it comes to cellos.
I mean, I should mention at this point that you have a long-term partner, you have a son, but the way you talk about these instruments, it's as though you have a... I wouldn't dare say an equal relationship with them, but it's clearly a very deep, significant connection.
It is. I very much feel that the cello is part of me when I play. And yes, it is like a marriage, and yet I don't think I can be accused of adultery.
The cellist Stephen Isserlis. Next time on Desert Island Discs, you'll be able to hear the artist Lubaina Himid. Join us then.
We choose to go to the moon.
40 feet down, 2.5.
Neil said, we can't land here.
Picking up some dust.
Everyone is sitting there not knowing what has happened.
30 seconds.
We might not make it.
I'm Kevin Fong, and 50 years on, I'll be telling the story of the Apollo moon landings in a brand new podcast from the BBC World Service.
Well, that's just crazy to try to do something as dangerous as that around the moon.
100 feet, 3.5 down, 9-4.
I thought, wow, what have I had gotten myself into?
Roger, 1202, we copy.
I'm looking at my displays, and I am in big trouble.
13 Minutes to the Moon.
Available now on BBC Sounds.